Okay, so this is the second day of our end of the retreat. So we're at the beginning of the retreat within the retreat. The group practice period is lovely time to come together and support each other with meditation practice and walking, sitting, being in the cloister area together, support each other. And just to be aware of the state of mind. If it's sitting within the knowledge of this being close to the end of the three-month retreat, then there might be a sense of moving on to the next thing if you're going to be leaving the monastery, or if you've got projects within the monastery and are staying, moving in those directions towards engagement activity, at least in the mind, and to just watch that. Becoming energy, that's what it is. It's that bhava tanha, which many of us are often caught up in from day to day, moment to moment, that forward thrust of being someone, getting something done, planning for something in the future, being anywhere but right here now. So get familiar with that if that's what's happening, anticipation. And just know that where we do need to do some sort of planning for the future, this is a opportunity to consolidate, pull together some things that maybe you've learned for the past 3 months and to consider how to maintain those, the right effort of maintaining skillful qualities that have been developed and how to carry those forward without losing them, without losing skillful momentum. We can practice and want to leave behind the unskillful momentum. That's useful too. But if there's something that you've developed some insight around or some way of approaching your life, your practice, your mind, then to reflect on that, cultivate that, nurture that, and contemplate how to maintain that. What would it take to maintain those qualities that you've realized over the past 3 months. And keep the long-term perspective. I think that's what we have to offer as a community here, as an example of maintaining a long-term perspective. The people who have committed to stay here at the monastery, I think, had a pretty strong sense of how important it is over the long term, to keep the focus without getting distracted, not just making it an isolated time and then going back to everything just as it was before. But the practice to gain real long-term benefits, one has to have a very long-term perspective as well. And the Buddha offers a lot of teachings around that to help motivate us and remind us about the long-term perspective. Some of them very powerful reflections on samsara, the endless wandering, as beings that we've been doing since for an incalculable amount of time. There's a lovely phrase that or teaching that the Buddha gives as a reflection on the samsara that I often like to roll around in my mind if I need some inspiration to stay with it for the long term, which I actually don't need so much of these days. It's pretty well in there, I think. But I'll paraphrase here from the Buddha's teaching. It's this samsara is without a discernible beginning. Beings have been wandering, roaming on endlessly without any kind of discoverable beginning, without any kind of discernible beginning. Obstructed by ignorance, fettered by craving. For an incalculable amount of time, an undiscernible beginning. Obstructed by ignorance, hindered by craving, or fettered by craving. I think they're very powerful images, just the nature of ignorance being so obstructive to our clear seeing. And seeing things the way they are, and the tangle of suffering and the ways that we keep ourselves rolling in the suffering, the difficulty, and fettered by craving, just this ball and chain, this fetter, shackles of always this urge of wanting something, the three forms of craving. Those are the two most notable links in dependent origination that keeps us engaged in activities that always result in the end product of suffering. These are two points that the Buddha talks to or mentions about, that if we address them, this is where we can break the links most easily. There are other places as well, but the links of ignorance and the links of craving are very notable places where the Buddha targets his teachings so that we can learn to undo the cycle that results in suffering, ignorance, craving. So, but just reflecting on the first part of the phrase, without discoverable beginning, can really reflect on that to induce a sense of urgency. There's no time to waste. You know, what are we waiting for? We probably know this deep in our hearts, but the mind comes up with all sorts of excuses to get distracted with, to follow the urges of craving, wanting, desire, aversion, confusion, anxiety, questioning our role in the world. What are we doing here? Why are we here? What should we be doing? How should we be spending our time? Throwing up all of these mental states to confuse us. Mara is continually at work, trying to get us off track. And so we have to use occasions like this and the people around us who are committed to the long term. We have to really reflect on that and use this support. It's here. Let it encourage and inspire for the long term, and start to contemplate how to, if you're not going to be here at the monastery in this support team here for a while, before you come back again the next time, how can you use that motivation that perhaps you've pulled into existence just to stay here for 3 months? How can you use that to keep the focus? Don't let it slide. And if you're staying here, how to use that same quality of focus and urgency to keep on track with the practice while you're here, not just to get lost in new projects or travels, wherever it is that you might be going next. All of that can be lost with becoming energy. So to scale back and be reflective and try and stay with what it is that's been very useful the past several months. Because life is short. Life is very short. We have, just this past few weeks, numbers of people, close supporters, very diligent, devoted, committed practitioners who are facing some very serious life challenges. Somebody that we were just talking about a few minutes ago who has a brain tumor and is going to be starting radiation or chemo, but there's no long-term hope that it's going to do any cure, you know, just buy some time. I have a friend up in Seattle who's dealing with ovarian cancer, a very long-term practitioner, and she's had some recurrences. It's not going to, someday it will get her, hopefully later rather than sooner, but one doesn't know. But it's a major struggle right now. And there's a sense of urgency for her friend down in the Bay Area who's, in just a couple of weeks, is going to have his entire bone marrow wiped out so that he can get a transplant, a bone marrow transplant, with the hopes of maybe treating some blood cancer that he has. Very serious. Another friend in the Bay Area who's going to be undergoing some open heart surgery for problems related to her heart valves, just like she had 10 years before and just like I had last year myself. fairly major heart surgery. So yeah, it's all happening. It's happening right in our very midst, and we need to take these examples to reflect, and not just in a real surface way, not just in a, oh, this is what I'm supposed to reflect on kind of a way, but really taking it in. This, I mean, some of these people aren't all that old. So taking it to heart, how do you want to spend the rest of your life? So the Buddha offers a lot of suggestions. We've been exploring the Satipatthana the past 3 months as tools to help free ourselves from this trap, in a sense, this trap of samsara. And there's a lot of tools out there that he offered for different ways of approaching our dilemma. And we've spent some really good time, really good readings and reflections on various teachings from Satipatthana aimed at undoing these problems of ignorance and craving, particularly many different approaches. Just to focus on those two aspects of ignorance and craving, I think of course, almost all of the Satipatthana contemplations will eventually come around to attacking, in a sense, the ignorance and the craving in one way or another, directly or more indirectly. But I think of two major avenues of contemplation that the Buddha talked about that we've spent a fair amount of time on, and their teachings that are embedded within his second major discourse and his third major discourse, the Anattalakkhana Sutta and the Fire Sermon. The Anattalakkhana Sutta being focused on the five khandhas and developing insight around the true nature of the five khandhas, and then with the Fire Sermon, the focus being on the six sense bases. And those are two Satipatthana, those are two themes of contemplation within the fourth Satipatthana, which we've had readings on, reflections on. And they both very clearly and strongly address the issues of both ignorance and craving in their own ways. I think if you kind of consider it closely, the teachings on the five khandhas have a bit more of an emphasis around dispelling ignorance, and the teachings around the six sense bases have a bit more of a focus around dispelling the craving. And of course, both of them can be used to develop both samatha and vipassana and approach both of those conflicts or obstructions in our life, ignorance and craving. But developing that contemplation on the five khandhas leads very clearly, if one follows the instructions, leads very clearly eventually to a very deep understanding and penetration that results in clear knowing and helps to dispel the ignorance of greed, hatred, and delusion, the ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, how suffering arises, and gives us insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta that lead to this experience of unbinding, of release. And the contemplation on the six sense bases will start to look at how we try to gain satisfaction, gains happiness in very surface ways through the sense bases, looking for gratification in the realm of the six sense bases, the five physical senses plus the mind base, the intellect base, looking for gratification and how to avoid unpleasant experience through the use of the six senses. So starting to understand those focuses, those focal points of our experience helps to illuminate how it is that we get caught in the cycle of samsara. And of course, within those broad categories, there's all sorts of contemplations and descriptions that the Buddha points to. And I mentioned the other night, Saturday night, did a bit of a reflection on the obstructions that are called the five hindrances and how to reflect on them in a positive way to help create a skillful set of conditions in the mind that are conducive to both calm and insight by eliminating the five hindrances and focusing on their counter qualities. And the Buddha talks about obstructions that we can learn from and help to eliminate in other ways too. One of the categories that I often like to reflect on are the 10 fetters, sanyojana, which are the fetters that bind us to samsara, that prevent us from seeing our way to complete freedom. They're obstructions, fetters, and there's that word again, fetters, things that bind us, hold us down. And Ajahn Sumedho likes to talk about them quite a bit in his teachings, has over the decades. And I've always appreciated his reflections on that. 10 fetters, I think most of you are familiar with by now. The first three being personality or identity view and skeptical doubt and attachment to rules and conventions or rites and rituals. Those being the first three that, when they're eliminated, give the entry into the stream of Dhamma. You've seen enough to know that this is the path to the ending of dukkha and for the full realization of complete freedom. So eliminating those first three fetters is what Ajahn Sumedho spends a lot of time instructing on, because if we can do that, then we're on the road. You know, we've made a significant dent in our suffering, and in a sense, we're almost guaranteed in a way to continue on. We're seeing the path beyond doubt. And he calls those first three fetters, he calls those artificial conditioning, which I really have appreciated contemplating since I heard that phrase, which wasn't that long ago, just a few years ago, that I heard him use that reference to the first three fetters as being artificial conditioning, whereas the other seven fetters of sensual desire, ill will, and those being the fourth and fifth, and then desire for existence in the material realm, desire for existence in the immaterial realm, and then the final three fetters of conceit and subtle restlessness and ignorance. Those last seven fetters being the basis for our rebirth as a human being, they almost come innate to the form. That's how we got here. And that the first three fetters, as he terms artificial conditioning, are add-on, even further add-ons to the mess that we've decided to pick up and get lost in that are not necessarily part of the package that we bring with us into the human realm, into this human rebirth. And I've always appreciated that, because that means that there's a fairly reasonable ability to address those first three fetters as human beings and just stop adding more and more complexity to the dilemma that we already face of trying to eliminate the more subtle forms of greed, hatred, and delusion. But we don't need to add the first three fetters unnecessarily. The first one of identity view, sakkaya ditti, being this belief in a permanent self of some sort, whether it's a soul or just our body or our minds or some combination of our khandhas, that this is who we are. And we believe it and we operate from it and get lost in it. And if we can see that clearly and understand the illusion of that view and relinquish it, then that's a major step in undoing the cycle of dukkha. And it goes along with the other two fetters of skeptical doubt, like unsure whether this is the right path, whether it's going to result in what the Buddha says it's going to result in, this kind of freedom, this disentanglement. And then also the attachment to rules and conventions, thinking that just by merely performing some sort of spiritual program or activity, sitting for so many hours, walking for so many hours, chanting for so many hours, or performing certain devotional offerings, that somehow just those things in and of themselves are going to produce freedom. It's not that we don't engage in these kinds of things, as obviously we do, but we do them with the perspective of them being aids on our path, not as answers in and of themselves. So letting go of those first three fetters, once we've done that and eliminated the doubt about the path and the efficacy of it, and have eliminated this very strong sense of self, the illusion, the delusion of I, me and mine, I making my making, then we've secured our path. And the rest isn't necessarily easy, but it's a whole lot more straightforward. So just to imagine what it might be like to be free of those first three fetters, you can enjoy the chanting, the rituals, the different things that we do to help support our practice as part of the path, and you can participate in them wholeheartedly and without questioning them too much, but you don't believe in them as a in and of themselves as what's going to free you. They're aids and partners on the path, and they can be quite beautiful. You just have to allow yourself to sink into them and enjoy them and not hold them for anything more than what they are, but use them very skillfully. And that's being freed from that sense of that this is what you have to do in order to get enlightened. And that also accompanies this elimination of doubt. You've practiced with the Buddhist path through these various teachings that we've been talking about. You've seen some benefit. You've experienced at least some sense of freedom from something along the way, hopefully, and can see that even though you may have a long way to go, the Buddha was pretty brilliant in what he discovered and how he expounded it, how he presented it to us as a teaching for so many years, and how long it's lasted. So that there's this sense of faith and confidence. This is, if you want to end suffering, you take this to the full extent. And there's no question that it will take you to the goal of complete release, complete freedom, complete understanding. Number of lifetimes, but up to seven more, as they say, but you have that confidence, and it's an unshakable confidence. That's a really nice feeling, to have that kind of surety and trust and resolution and refuge. It just not to be filled with that kind of doubt and questioning. But it takes commitment. It takes an initial form of faith based on things have worked out pretty well so far. You can't see anything wrong with the path. So why not jump in and try my best? It takes that to get to that point of eliminating the doubt on the path. And then that first fetter of identity view, so important, because we don't operate with the belief in a sense of self or in a sense of ownership of anything that we could call a self. We've seen through this illusion that there is an independent agent here who can control what ultimately happens with this body and with this intellect. And even though we may have not completely eliminated that fetter of conceiving, which is later down the line, the conceiving I am, there's still this subtle sense of an independent being operating, but there's not this belief in this body and this mind being who I am. And there still is an experience of agency, but it's quite a bit weakened, and there are these opportunities in these moments of moving through the world completely alert, aware, still suffering with desires and discontents, and trying to figure out skillful ways to be with those and to handle those, to restrain from engaging in all the things that we can do to keep on brewing more unhappiness. But there's not a sense of a strong sense of me having to do it. It just becomes the thing to do based on skillful mind states and remembering mindfulness and applying for ourselves right effort, just that constant commitment to upholding the wholesome and letting go, eliminating, abandoning the unwholesome. But there's not a strong sense of me having to do that. It's just what it is that has to be done. So what a tremendous amount of freedom that means. So we work towards understanding, contemplating, and eliminating those first three fetters through our practice, through the satipatthana that we've been emphasizing the past 3 months. Contemplation of the khandhas to break through the ignorance, contemplation of the six sense bases to help get a handle and cut the craving, and then all the other contemplations that work in the same way. And then we start to also work simultaneously on the other fetters, particularly the desire, number four, and the ill will, number five, to start whittling those down and eventually eliminating them, and then moving on to the more subtle last five fetters, the desire for material existence in the material realm, rupa raga, the form realm, arupa raga, the desire for existence within the immaterial realm. And these are all forms of bhava tanha. If we've eliminated the fourth and fifth fetters of craving and ill will, then it's the sixth and seventh, the craving and the ill will being sort of the kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, and then these next two of rupa raga and arupa raga being more along the lines of the craving for becoming, bhava tanha. And then working with those to just let go of that desire for becoming existence, and starting to subtly see the subtle forms of conceit, conceiving, mana, which is described in some beautiful ways in the suttas of being sort of the flower isn't the pistils, the existence of the flower isn't found in the pistils or the stamen or the petals or the stems or the leaves, but you haven't eliminated the fact that there's still a scent, so that this sense of this subtle sense of conceiving I am is like the scent of a flower. It's not a belief in the whole thing of self, but there's still the operating from that standpoint of a reference point of self. So we react to the world with that subtle notion, even though we don't believe that that's who we are. So we start to unravel that one as well. And then the subtle restlessness, udaccha, that comes along with this wondering when it is that we will be realizing the fruits of our practice, this kind of subtle agitation in the mind that's still searching, still not quite there yet, still a bit restless. And then when all of those are finally eradicated, the eradication of avijja, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, and how we keep on getting ourselves caught up in the cycle of dukkha, a full penetration of that, full penetration of the Four Noble Truths. And with that is the completion of the practice of eliminating the 10 fetters that obstruct us from full realization. But it starts out with this really getting to understand what it is that we refer to as ourselves, the five khandhas, how that is obstructive to us, and really deeply penetrating the roots of that delusion, that ignorance, and simultaneously seeing how the forms of the various forms of craving just result in this movement of mind always towards something, away from something, constant reactivity, constant seeking some sort of gratification in the realm of samsara, and not quite seeing how to relinquish and let go of that whole process, because it's always temporary. It's always going to change. And we have to get that over and over and over again before we're willing to let go of it all and just stop doing it. But it takes a commitment. I remember many years ago, one of the monastic conferences, one of the early monastic conferences that we were having here in the States, where a number of different traditions would come together and meet together for a few days. One of them was when Bhikkhu Bodhi was attending. It was back on the East Coast at the Bhavana Society that this particular session was happening. And his comments, we were talking about Buddhism coming to the West and the various challenges that it faces. And his comments always have stuck with me about as Buddhism has come to the West, it's come in many very useful and good forms. But what it has seemed to neglect in the way that it's come in terms of meditation centers, retreat centers, and kind of very, very thin on the side of the monastic presence or what the monastic community can contribute, that what it brought with it is a lack of teachings around two things that aren't uniquely monastic, but have a strong flavor in monasticism or the monastic or committed lay practitioner approach. And those two qualities being renunciation, development of renunciation, and the perspective of transcendence, that a lot of the goals of the practice are talked about in terms of well-being, personal well-being, psychological well-being, how to live more functional life. All of these are good things, how not to get caught up in our old habits that lead to all sorts of different kinds of suffering, but don't really point to a long-term transcendence, particularly with the perspective of rebirth, from the rounds of rebirth. That's not a popular topic as Buddhism has come to the West. So that as committed practitioners, lay or monastic, people who have seen that there is a more than just a how to make our lives more functional, more skillful, resulting in a form of happiness, but not looking at the long term and the potential for complete transcendence in its most fullest sense, complete elimination of suffering, and that it takes relinquishment, it takes renunciation, it takes giving up of some of the, not only the material pursuits that keep us going, chugging from day to day to day to day just to maintain material comfort, but also the pursuits of all the conditions that we think will bring us happiness in the world of relationships, people, engagement, success, gain, honor, and fame, those kinds of things. How to say, okay, well, there's something beyond this, and I want to commit myself to a complete understanding of this and how to be free, completely free. Not that other thing, good things can't come along the way, and it doesn't mean we want to discourage other people who aren't fully committed. We want to encourage that. But for ourselves, to maintain that focus, what is the long-term potential? And what can I do with the rest of this life, this very short life? What can I do to maximize that potential and see it through to the end, to the full realization of freedom, the best I can? And if I don't complete my work this time, to set the stage to continue on in a very sincere, in a sincerer way the next time around. So to contemplate these kinds of things for the next week or so of our group practice, coming together to support each other in this endeavor, what do I want to reinforce? What do I want to maintain? What do I want to continue to develop? What do I want to bring with me when I get onto my next set of duties, where I go, when I get to the next monastery that I'm going to go to, when I go back to my job, my livelihood, or my family, or my friends, my relationships, wherever it is that I find myself moving next? What do I want to bring with me? Because life keeps on going on until it doesn't. And then something else will pick up if we haven't finished our work. And what do we want to condition the next moment with, whether it's the next moment when we leave the monastery, the next moment when we take on a new venue, the next moment when we get old and get sick, and the next moment when we die? What do we want to be bringing with us? So to focus on that, use that as a motivation and as a guide for the next bit of time. So I'll leave that for this evening. It's time for, if anybody has any questions or thoughts.
Thank you so much for your talk. So it seems like the Buddha, even after he, like, quote unquote, completed the path to liberation, he still sat a lot and practiced Dhamma, and like basically seems like continued to do the path anyways. And I guess I would like to hear your thoughts on like why and like what that's about.
Ooh, a couple of things. Probably foremost, primarily out of compassion for all the other sentient beings in the world, who have just a little bit of dust in their eyes and can benefit. Because as you probably know from the story, his first inclination, at least according to the scriptures, was to just, you know, check out and enjoy the bliss of enlightenment. And it was going to be too complicated. to, you know, this is too subtle. People won't understand it. People can't possibly repeat what it is that he has discovered. It's just way too subtle. And then, of course, as the story goes, he was beseeched by a Brahma god to reconsider that. And he surveyed the world and saw those beings who did have just a little dust in their eyes and realized that there was potential. And realizing that he had the capacity to pass that on his discovery, and ended up, of course, you know, helping many, many, many beings cross over to freedom. So I think compassion was probably one of his motivating forces. But also just the, you know, while his life force was living out, he still, you know, had, as it turns out, quite a few years of living to go, how to not only out of compassion teach the Dhamma and other people, getting other people to come to the same understanding that he had, but also all the contemplations that he would engage in and spend time with, and meditation and solitude, were because they were naturally enjoyable in a very healthy, good kind of a way, in a very refreshing way that would support his being in the world to help. So it was both for his own comfort and benefit that he would continue to reflect. It wasn't work. It wasn't like he had to sit down and discipline himself to, you know, sit for an hour every night before he went to bed. He is because it was naturally what he was inclined to do, and as a support for this major endeavor to share what he could for as long as he could. Those are the thoughts that come up for me.
I just remember something. This must have been 15, 20 years ago. We were asking on board. It might have been at like a midnight tea or something. And I said, why, you know, if arahants have finished, you know, they've learned what they needed to learn, then why do they need to, yeah, similarly, like, what are they doing, you know, meditating and you know, still spending many hours doing similar things they were doing before to realize Nibbana, if they've already realized it. And so I said, their learning's done. And he said, no. Their learning's just started. And their education has just begun, because they've cleared their minds of all obstructions, and now they can see clearly. And so all of these suttas that we get from the Buddha, are they before his enlightenment? You know, no, they're after. And they're not necessarily something that we can say he formulated in his head, like, just the moment he was enlightened, all of that was there. That was stuff that I think a lot of it was, you know, came up from, like, oh, how do I teach this particular person and that particular person and this and that? So there was still a lot of learning that he could now benefit from, because his mind was clear. It was no longer obstructed. But he wasn't suffering. You know, that's the main thing. So he could see very clearly. And through that ability, then he could discern, like, so many different ways of teaching people and helping people. And but I don't think it meant that there was any delusion there or ignorance. It was just like, oh, you know, well, there's this too, and there's that. You know, there's just a very broadening of understanding. And again, there wasn't sinking down into the muck then of being confused. So it's like, well, where are all these brilliant teachings coming from? They're coming from an enlightened mind. And I think that's the benefit of, like, you know, he didn't just stop. He didn't just, oh, that's it. I don't need to do anything else. I'm done. It was like, no, there's this benefit and understanding that could be transferred to others.
Yeah, it's like he wasn't suffering anymore, and he wouldn't be capable of falling into any kind of suffering, but he could still develop skills.
Yeah.
Skill and teach development. Them. Yeah.
Yeah, and teach those skills. And thankfully he did.
Yes, thankfully for all of us.
That actual sutta that you brought up where Sambhati asks him to teach. Mm. It's right before that, then he did try to teach, and the fellow who asked him, like, wow, you look amazing, your countenance is so bright, and who's your teacher? And he's like, I don't have a teacher, I'm self-awakened. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go beat the drum to the deathless and awaken everybody else up. I'm gonna go help people. Or that was right. That must have been probably right after. Sorry. And the guy was like, okay, I'm going to go over here.
Good for you.
Good for you. And he had to temper his teaching. So, that was kind of like a lot of people look in the suttas, they think of the Buddha as he's incapable of making a mistake. He's the perfect teacher. But actually, in that moment, he wasn't, and he had to temper what was applicable to a person who was approaching him, and what was right to say, and he did. He changed it for each person. So it's also like he's learning. He actually learned. And sometimes when you think about our rules and our vinaya, like if he wasn't learning, then the rules would be set down, and there wouldn't be. I mean, this is how I interpret it. There wouldn't be any changes, but there were lots of changes. Because you see, like, okay, this is what needs to be introduced as something that will help the monks or the lay people, whatever, to curtail their ignorance and their craving and the problems they're having. And then you see, oh, was that, how did that work out? And in some ways, there were changes because it's like, oh, maybe that's not quite exactly how it's going to help. And so maybe change it this way or that way. So it was, what's beautiful, I think, about the Buddha and his life is that he was capable of change, and he was capable of seeing, like, oh, adjustments need to be made, and different people need to be taught in different ways, and it's not all this kind of just like absolute way that there's no sense of seeing, like, I don't need to change that. You see people in denial sometimes, like that unfortunate sense of like feeling or stating or believing they don't have everything they've said is absolute and correct. And he was able to adjust a lot because he's dealing with samsara in the human realm, which is so fallible. It's had so many problems. So you have to figure out, like, what is appropriate in this situation and that. And